The sixth, the view that is noble and emancipating.
Yeah.
Can you explain more about that? Like how do we practice? Or I cannot get a picture. How should we practice? Or how should we?
How to practice that view? Yeah.
what is that? Can you give more example on this?
Yeah. It means the view of the noble ones, right? The view that you get when you see reality according to reality. So when you become a stream mentor, or maybe not quite a stream mentor, but when you become what they call a sadanusari, dhammanusari, on the path of stream mentoring, that's the kind of view you're talking about. So it is what that view is. It's basically, it's a vision of the truth. It's like you get into samadhi, and then you have what they call yathabhutananadasana, seeing things in accordance with reality. That's what it is. And that seeing, remember, there's three things they talk about in Buddhism, seeing things according to reality. You see impermanence, you see suffering, and you see non-self, right? And you see it with a reference to yourself, who you are as a person. So you are... To give an example, we're going to look at this more in more detail later on, but when you go through your meditation practice, the more deeply you go into that meditation practice, the more you see things fading away, your body fading away, right, the thoughts fading away. This is ideally what happens. It doesn't always happen, but ideally these things happen. Thoughts fading away, body fading away, hindrances fading away, and there's less and less left. Yeah. You know, the idea with meditation is to focus on one object exclusively, just to be with the breath. Everything else is gone. So what you're seeing there is you're seeing impermanence, right? Things fading away. You're saying that actually it's much more happy when these things fade away. So you understand it's all dukkha, right? Getting rid of all that stuff. And also, things that fade away, they cannot be an essential part of who you are, because an essential part always must be present. So if it fades away, can't be an atta either. Can't also must be non-self. Yeah, so this is what you see with reference to yourself. And when that seeing vision is taken all the way to the core, all the way to the bottom, you see everything like that, right? That is where you have this view that is noble and emancipating. It leads out to the final end of suffering here. So you can't do that view. You can't kind of say, okay, I'm going to view the world like that. You have to experience it, right? That's the only way really here. You happy with that? I'm not so happy. Yes. Yeah. Okay, great. Okay, good. Uncertain. No, that's the view of the stream entry. So before you even get there, you have to get to samadhi first of all, right? And the interesting thing is that this view kind of gradually arises as you move towards samadhi, because you see more and more things as impermanent, more and more things as suffering, etc. So it gradually comes into being, and then one day, bang, you see everything. And that's when you are a stream entry here. Okay, so that's how it goes. Okay, so shall we continue? Yeah. There's a couple of people missing, but they will have to catch up later on. So, okay, now we come to the very last simile in the simile of the soul, and this is what the whole sutta is named after. So now we come to the actual simile of the soul itself. Because even if bandits were to sever you savagely limb by limb with a two-handled saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. Herein, bhikkhus, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected. We shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. And we shall abide pervading them with a mind imbued with loving kindness, and starting with them, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how you should train, bhikkhus. So this is where we're really raising the stakes to the absolute maximum, right? A bandit comes along, has this saw, this old saw with big teeth, and they pin you to the ground, they hold you down, and they start sawing you apart, limb by limb. First one leg, then the one arm, then the other arm, and they saw you to bits and pieces. And while you are lying there, all you have is compassion and kindness. May you be well, may you be happy. Right? This is what this is saying, quite literally. So this is kind of raising the bar of metta to the absolute maximum. Somebody really abusing you in the worst possible way, and still you have a mind of metta. And the only way that you can understand this. The only way to see how this works is to understand that what you are doing here is that you are focusing on the unskillfulness of the other person, on their stupidity, on their delusion, on the enormous amount of bad karma they are creating for themselves, right? Understand that the other person, they are really confused about reality. They have no idea how to live life in such a way as to be happy. So you turn away from your own pain and you understand the other person instead. This is what you're doing here. You understand that it's not actually personal. One of the reasons why we get upset with other people is we feel it is personal. They are doing it against me, right? That's why we get upset. But it's not personal. Things are never personal in this world. The reason why they are doing this is because of their own inner demons, their own bad habits, their own delusion, their own stupidity. They don't know. They don't really care whether it's you or somebody else they're sawing up, right? Or maybe you just happen to be the wrong person at the wrong time. But there's nothing really personal about you. It's just that you happen to be there at that time. And so they kind of do it to you instead. So you remember all of that. And if you take away this feeling that it is personal, you're taking away a lot of the problem that actually comes from ill will. Ill will very often has this feeling, they are doing it towards me. They are not doing it towards you. They are doing it because of their own inner conditioning. That is the only reason why people do these things. And then you realize that, well, all I have to do is I have to bear up with this pain. Okay, this pain is really bad. It's really terrible pain. I have to bear up with it for a short time. Then I will probably die, right? If people cut off your legs and arms, probably you will die from bleeding or something. And then that's it. You're off, right? And you move on to the next generation because you have a mind of loving kindness. Wow, you go to this beautiful next destination. Whereas the scallywags who cut you up, where are they going to the next destination? Pretty bad. So you can see the difference there. For you, it's a short-term thing that you have to bear with. It's no big deal. Okay, it is a big deal in those moments, right? But it's in the long term, it's not a big deal. So you can deal with that. And instead, you look at what is happening to the other person. For them, it really is a major, major, major problem. So it's all about perception, how we look at the world. And if you perceive things in the right way, it is astonishing what abilities we have to deal with our mind in a skillful way. It really is astonishing. And of course, the Buddha says that... And this is kind of the hard part here, right? If you give rise to a mind of ill will in this case, you're not practicing my teachings. So it's a very high bar. To really practice the Buddha's teachings fully, it is a very high ask. That's what he's basically saying here. So that is that very famous simile of the saw. And then starting with those people, right? Start with cutting up limb by limb, loving kindness to them, and then you spread it out to the whole world. And this beautiful way that it ends here, a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, without limits, right? Immeasurable, no limits anywhere, no hostility and no ill will. This is how you should train bhikkhus. And then the Buddha says, "Bhikkhus, if you keep this advice of the simile of the saw constantly in mind, do you see any way of speech, trivial or gross, that you could not endure? No, venerable sir. Therefore, bhikkhus, you should keep this advice on the simile of the saw constantly in mind. That will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time." Nice, isn't it? Yeah. And of course, when we say keeping it constantly in mind, it doesn't mean that you always think about this, because that is impossible. But it's a bit like you have it at the back of your mind. It's there as a backup. And when you need it, it comes out into your conscious mind. That's really what it means. It doesn't mean that you think about this all the time, because that really is impossible. But it's there, very close to the surface, ready to be dragged out. Remember the idea of the shelf of perceptions? You have that on the shelf of perceptions there, ready to be used at a time of difficulty. Pulling it down, countering any kind of anger or negativity in your mind. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Simile of the saw, Majjhima Nikaya 21. So, everybody happy with that? Yeah? Anybody not happy? Anybody thinks it's asking too much? Oh, asking too much. It is asking too much, isn't it? So remember that one of the things is that these things are there to inspire us, right? To remind us what is possible with the human mind, what actually can be done. There are people in this world today who actually live like this. Of course, here we are probably talking about Aryas, we're probably talking about Arahants even, to be able to live like this at a very, very high level. Perhaps there are a few people who get very good samadhi who can live like this. But it's something to be aspired for. It's something to kind of to be in awe that it's possible to develop the human mind to this extent and the human heart to this extent. There's something to be glad about that this is possible. Because otherwise, if you think, oh, it's asking too much, then it can maybe drag you down a little bit rather than actually lift you up and inspire you in the right way. I don't know, I find this very inspiring. I find that it's always something very nice to be aimed at. Yes, it is a high bar to get over, but actually it is also it's something really, really worthwhile. If you can live like that, your entire attitude, your entire personality, who you are as a person, has been completely transformed, and you are so... You live a life which is very different from an ordinary life, a life of great happiness and ease in almost all circumstances. So these are one of those things that are very incredibly worthwhile, of course, to move towards. It may take a long time, but on that way, as you are practicing towards these incredibly lofty things, you also experience so much happiness and joy on the way itself. The path is full of happiness. As I said in the beginning, you start off by experiencing the bliss of blamelessness, then the unsullied bliss, right? And after the unsullied bliss comes the bliss of just meditation practice, deeper and deeper meditation, and eventually you come to this kind of bliss we're talking about here. It's way down the road, but in the meantime, already, there's a lot of happiness to be had on this path. And this is what is so extraordinary about this path. It's like, as they say, happiness upon happiness upon happiness, one thing after the other, leading onwards. Right? It's a kind of a marvelous and astonishing thing that such a teaching should exist in the world. It's not obvious at all, but it does. So, any questions about this sutta? Yes.
When the awakened one has the equanimity, why do we say that the Nibbana is the highest happiness? Because there's supposed to be this equanimity. So I couldn't understand why there's this highest happiness.
It is hard to understand, isn't it? It is very hard to understand. But the point is, and this is kind of what is so difficult about this, is that the point is that equanimity is a higher happiness than happiness. Yeah, this is kind of the point here. This is what is so hard to understand, because as you go through the very deep stages of samadhi, the happiness gets more and more refined. And when you come to the third jhana, what you are experiencing, it says in there, kayena sukkang patisangvedeti, they experience happiness directly, immediately, is what it says there. This is the highest kind of happiness you can experience as a happy feeling. But then you go from the third jhana into the fourth jhana, and you leave that happiness behind, and all you have left is upeka, and you have adukkamasukha, neither happiness nor pain. And that upeka is a higher kind of pleasure than the happiness that you have in the third jhana. That is what it's saying. It's hard to understand, isn't it? Very hard to understand. But there's something about that upeka which is more peaceful, more sublime, more wonderful than even the highest kind of happiness. So when you feel, wow, so happy, right? Actually, still not happy enough. Still can go further than that. And this is the thing, it kind of goes on and on and on. And that is one of the reasons why it is, you know, it's very difficult to understand this idea of Nibbana, which is the complete extinguishment of everything, everything kind of disappearing in a sense. But once you understand that upeka, equanimity, is a higher happiness than happiness, you can start to understand why everything being extinguished actually is the happiest feeling is possible to have. You can't really call it a feeling, but it's the happiest state. A state doesn't really quite work either, because it's not really a state either. It is the highest happiness anyway, when everything is extinguished. And this is kind of the weird thing. There's a nice sutta about that there somewhere in the where the Venerable Sariputta, I think, is speaking to the Buddha. And he says that, and somebody asked him, as Venerable Udayan, who's a bit of a scallywag monk, and he says to Venerable Sariputta, how can Nibbana be the highest happiness if nothing is felt there? And Venerable Sariputta says, it is precisely because nothing is felt there that it is the highest kind of happiness. Right? So these things are very hard to kind of get your mind wrapped around. You need some really profound insight to really understand these things. But that is how the suttas tend to work with this. Okay.
Okay. Bhante, in this particular sutra, the middle three items there, the one about removing all the earth, painting on empty space, and then evaporating river Ganges, they don't seem to suggest that there is any harm done to an individual. So in other words, how does that relate to the practice of metta in this case? Because these are three things done, three things that these silly people try to do.
Yeah.
So what has that got to do with metta in this case?
The metta is that you are the earth, right? You are the earth. So you, the other person is the kind of the antagonist coming to give you a hard time. But you are the earth. You are the river Ganges. You are the empty space, right? And the earth cannot be touched. The earth has metta for the person who comes. Yeah?
So this is like a metaphor that these things that he's trying to do is actually he's doing to you.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. So, good, I'm glad, yes, please, oh, not quite happy yet, okay, yeah.
Because I learned from different teachers, from the metta, then, like, this one is like, when people scold me, hurt me, then I can send metta to people.
Yeah.
In the metta retreat, after the metta retreat for a few weeks, I can do that. Then after that, I lack of practice. Then sometimes people scold me, immediately a reaction come up. Yeah, so is this people saying that is those kind of samadhi is the stone put on the grass is just temporary. So when we have no practice of samadhi, then the grass will continue to grow. And then the next one is people saying that if we keep practice metta, then we cannot wash our aversion. So, should we wash the aversion or should we practice the metta?
Okay.
Two questions here.
Okay, two questions. Okay. So, I'll answer the last one first about washing aversion and practicing metta. Remember, what is the reason why you want to watch aversion in the first place? The reason why you want to watch it is so you can overcome it. That's the whole point. So you're watching aversion so as to understand the causes and conditions that give rise to it, to understand what it feels like, to understand what it leads to. And once you understand it, you can get rid of it. That's the whole point of that. There's no point of watching it just for the sake of watching it, right? There's a reason. It's about insight and understanding. And then you overcome it. And when you overcome it, that's it. You don't need to watch it anymore. So if you have so much metta that you there's no aversion there, great. You have done the job. You've done the right thing. No need to watch the aversion anymore, right? This is the whole point. The watching is for the purpose of overcoming. If you have overcome, no issues. Yeah? It's like people say sometimes about like jhana practice. When you practice jhanas, the body is gone. But that means that you cannot do any body contemplation. But the whole purpose of body contemplation is to overcome the body so you can get into jhana, right? So there's no point. Once you have gotten into jhana, you already have overcome the body. So that's not an issue anymore. No need to contemplate it anymore. So this is a gradual path. And you have to kind of, when you get these things in the right order, then you know what's going on there. So this is that is the first one, and the second one is about the samadhi, kind of temporarily, you kind of hold it down, and it comes back with a vengeance later on when you get back into society again. Oh, so nice and peaceful in the retreat, and then you come back into the ordinary world, and you don't know what to do about these things. And that is a good point, but remember that whenever you have had an experience like that on a retreat and you feel more at ease, you feel more peaceful, there is no aversion there. You already had some insight and understanding about these issues. You know an alternative state. You know a different reality from the ordinary things. And that knowledge of a different reality has made an impact in your mind that will stay with you for a long time in the future. You know it is possible to abandon these things. You know what it's like. And that will give you the desire to continue the practice, right? If you've never seen those things, you have no idea about them, there's very little motivation inside of you to actually go in that direction. So you are really lucky. You should be so happy that you had those experiences, because now this will carry you forward and keep on practicing in the right way for a long time in the future. Yes, when you come out into society, it will come back again, and that will remind you of some of the deficiencies of living in society as well, right? Because you know sometimes it is impossible to live around people in an ordinary way without having these kind of reactions. It is just too much input. Mindfulness isn't strong enough to see what's going on. And before you know it, things are coming out of your mouth, as you were saying, that you don't really want to come out of your mouth, right? And this is the reality. This is the reality of things. So there's many things going on there. You start to see the deficiency. You start to move towards more towards spiritual practice. You become less interested in society because you know where real happiness is to be found and where the false gold is to be found. We talked about the false gold earlier on in this retreat. And then you start to distinguish. You understand, you know, how this path actually works. So don't. It's natural that these up and downs come, but already you have a lot of advantages from having seen those things. Yeah, and one day you think, whoa, I have to become a monk, there's no choice in this. And then you come up and we will, you know, you get your head shaven and then you're kind of peaceful in the monastery. That's the way to go. Are you happy with that? Yeah? Okay, great. Okay, anyone else like to say anything? Okay, good. So it's great. It's good to be happy when you read about metta, otherwise it kind of doesn't work. If you read about metta and you feel grumpy afterwards, it's kind of unfortunate. Okay, so now we are going in a slightly different direction. So now we're going to have we had a look at anger and metta and how to deal with these things. And now I want to have a little bit of a look at sensuality and the sensual objects of the world. This is not perhaps as relevant for lay people as it is for monastics, but I still think it is important, because if we can reduce a little bit our attachment to the external world, to external phenomena, to all the things in life, and reduce those desires and cravings a little bit, it will always be very helpful. And this is not about making your life miserable, right, so that you feel really bad about everything and you can't have any desires and enjoy your food and going down into the city and finding new restaurants, as somebody was mentioning the other night. It's not really about that. These are things to be reflected upon and thought about. And when you reflect upon these similes that we find in the sutta, it leads to a natural, if you like, turning away of the mind, to away from the sensual objects, towards more peace and towards more inner stability, if you like. These are more reflections, right? You don't take these things literally and then stop having all fun in life, because if you stop having all fun in life, you'll be really miserable. You get depressed, you'll commit suicide, and I will have been an incredibly bad teacher as a consequence if that happens. So that is certainly not the point here. The point is just to have a natural movement, using our wisdom, using our understanding, to move in line with the Dhamma, line with the Buddhist teachings. If you think about these things in the right way, that is going to happen. But remember that, like as with so many things in life, it takes a little bit of effort. You have to keep thinking about these things again and again and again. And sometimes when I look at my own monastic life, I think sometimes I'm so stupid, so thick, right? I've been thinking about these things for so long, and it's only slowly, 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 gradually, gradually, it kind of seeps in the meaning of these things, what it really is about. And it shows me how much effort, how much wisdom, how much you need to read these things again and again and again for gradually these things to sink in and to start to see the truth. Right? So all of these things need that reflection and contemplation for them really to have an effect. So this is the Portalia Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, one of the most powerful suttas on sensual pleasures. When we use the word sensual pleasures in English, it refers to a word called kama in Pali. There's two words in Pali. One is kama, one is kamma. Kamma is action. Kama is sensual pleasures. Slightly different spelling here. And when we talk about sensual pleasures, we mean two things. We mean, first of all, the internal inner desire that we have for the sensual pleasures of the world, on the one hand. And on the one other hand, we also mean the objects of the world, the objects that actually attract us and that we attach to. So both of those things are meant by sensual pleasures here. And so this is how it works, right? So this is the first simile here. And householder, suppose a dog overcome by hunger and weakness was waiting by a butcher's shop. Then a skilled butcher or his apprentice would toss the dog a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood. What do you think, householder? Would that dog get rid of his hunger and weakness by gnawing such a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because that was a skeleton of well-hacked, clean-hacked, meatless bones smeared with blood. Eventually that dog would reap weariness and disappointment. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a skeleton by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. Right? So here you have this idea of a dog running around, running down to the butcher shop. And of course here the dog is just a simile for a person. And he's running down to the butcher shop because the butcher always has some goods, right? Waiting outside. Dogs, they like meat. So sitting outside the butcher shop waiting for the meat to come out of the butcher shop. So finally he can still the hunger, right? The craving is very strong. That's why it is running down to the butcher shop. But then eventually when the butcher finally throws something out. It's a skeleton. There is no meat on it. There's nothing there because the meat is too valuable to give to a dog, right? So all that is left is a bit of blood on the skeleton. And then the dog kind of gnaws that skeleton and tries to eat and gets a little bit of taste of the meat. But there is no satisfaction there. No real satisfaction. No ending to the craving. The craving just continues on. And then the dog runs off to the next butcher shop because it's what dogs do. And then the next butcher shop, exactly the same thing happens again. The next butcher does exactly the same thing, throws that skeleton out to the dog. And again, all it does, gets the taste of the blood, but no satisfaction, no completion, no fulfillment is actually happening. The craving doesn't even abate properly. And then it runs on to the next butcher shop. And so it goes on and on and on. And eventually the dog dies. And when the dog gets reborn, what happens? It starts all over again, running to the next butcher shop. But life after life, this is samsara, round and around and around. Always doing the same thing, no end in sight, being the slave of craving, being pulled by the nose, by the stupid craving, which never actually finds any fulfillment and satisfaction in the world. And this is a problem with sensual pleasures. Every time we indulge in sensual pleasures, it only gets rid of the craving for a very short period of time. The craving is gone, or sometimes the craving isn't even gone properly. It is still there in the background. And while you are indulging, there is craving there. And very soon afterwards, because you didn't find any real fulfillment or completion through that sensual pleasures, because you didn't find that, it re-arises again and comes back to you, and still you keep on running after it. And it's a beautiful simile for the problem of craving in the world, the problem of all the sensual pleasures that we run after. The problem is that they can never give any final and complete satisfaction. Why is that? What is the reason for that? And the reason is because the reason why we crave, it is almost as if there is a psychological hole inside of us. There's something missing inside of us psychologically. We're not really 100% content. We're not 100% satisfied. It's a psychological lack that we have inside of us. And that psychological lack can never be filled up by external things. Right? You keep on pursuing external things, but because it is an internal problem, you can never fill it up by external things. It's kind of weird. We run after things. We think almost everybody is like that. We think that external objects are somehow going to fill up this internal lack, the internal emptiness inside of us, the sense of actually not being complete. But it's obvious when you think about it that a psychological problem cannot be completed and gotten rid of by external things. So what do we have to do then? And this is also it becomes obvious once you start to understand that this is the problem, that we have to search for the solution inside of ourselves. Right? The solution is found by finding that fulfillment, finding that contentment inside, psychologically, inside our heart. And that, of course, is done by doing all of those things that give rise to inner happiness, inner contentment, inner sense of completion. As you practice the path, as you go up this path, and you find more and more of that kind of happiness, the less lack, the less hollow, the less empty you feel inside of yourself, the more fulfilled and the more complete you feel as a person. Until one day you enter a state of samadhi, and for the first time in your life, nothing is missing anymore. This is what samadhi is like. The contentment is complete. There's no lack anymore. And because there is no lack, because you feel a sense of completion, of happiness, of contentment inside of you, there is no more searching outside. And that is why there is no desire and no craving in samadhi. It's gone. Full happiness right here and right now. This is the power of these teachings and the power of this practice. And that is why samadhi, when you are in the jhana state, there is also no thinking about anything. The mind is completely at peace. All you have is that you are united with the object, which is the bliss, right? All you have is bliss. Whoa, nothing else. Nothing else happening at all. Complete satisfaction with that. No movement anywhere else. And it feels like, for the first time in your life, it feels like you have discovered the answer to the question of the meaning of life. This is what I have been looking for all along. This is what the craving was promising me. Craving said, when you get this, you will be satisfied. You will feel complete. The itch inside always moving on, dragging you on. The slave, craving being the slave driver, that is gone for the first time. You feel complete for the first time in your life. The thing that craving was promising you has been accomplished. Now you are there. You have achieved what you really wanted in the first place. Completion, satisfaction, no more itch, no more craving. No more of this driving force making you run around. That is what samadhi does to you. You feel like, quite literally, that you have reached the purpose of life itself. Of course, the problem is that if you attain samadhi, that is how you feel, but then you lose it again, right? Like you said at the back there, you lose it again, and then the craving returns. So we need something more than just samadhi, and that is where the insight comes into being, because the insight can actually enable us to make a final end of that craving, not just temporarily by samadhi, but the complete obliteration of those problems. Yeah, so this is the danger in sensual pleasures. And if you think about it, it actually makes incredibly good sense. It is not difficult to understand. It is difficult to understand completely, but to get some idea of what is going on here is not that hard. So contemplate this. Allow this to sink in, right? And as it gradually does, you start to see the flaws in how the vast majority of people lead their lives. They lead their life because they want happiness, because they want contentment, but they are going about it in completely the wrong way. all they are doing is perpetuating the craving, perpetuating the desire, running around life after life, making the same mistake again and again and again and again. And after making that mistake a few hundred times, a few thousand times, a few million times, right? Comes a point when you just had enough of making that mistake and say, okay, I'm really tired of running after these meatless bones. Had enough meatless bones. Now let's get some real satisfaction, something that really fills me up. And that's when you start moving on to the spiritual path. So these similes are very, I don't know, I find them incredibly powerful because they make it so clear what is going on with craving and you can really understand what is happening here. So that is the first simile, right? And it shows us why the sensual objects, this is specifically about the sensual objects, because the meat that the dog wants is the other objects in the world, and they never give you that taste of completion that they promise you. They are liars, basically, these external sensual objects and the way we think about them. Okay, let's move on to the next simile here. Householder, suppose a vulture, a heron, or a hawk seized a piece of meat and flew away, and then vultures, herons, and hawks pursued it and pecked and clawed it. What do you think, householder, if that vulture, heron, or hawk does not quickly let go of that piece of meat, wouldn't it incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a piece of meat by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. Here you have this simile, the piece of meat. Piece of meat, again, is like the objects in the world that we pursue, right? Anything that we are kind of trying to get hold of in this world, the objects of pleasure. And in this case, you have something nice in life, and then because you have something nice, other people, the other vultures, herons, and hawks, they come after you because they want it too, right? Especially in the animal world. The animal world is very brutal. When you live in nature like we do as monks, you see these things very clearly. It's a very brutal world, the animal world. And if one animal gets something nice, all the animals will run after it and try to tear it away from it. But the human realm is a little bit the same. Right? It's also a little bit like that. Finally, you find a nice partner in life, and then somebody else also wants that partner, and they try to tear that partner away from you. And then you suffer as a consequence, because your partner, perhaps they decide to leave you for somebody else. And this is the kind of the fighting over the sensual pleasures in the world. Or we compete for jobs, right? We compete for a higher salary. We compete for all of these things. Again, it is a fighting over the sensual objects in the world. When you are a child, you fight over the sweets, right? There's only one sweet left, but there's two children, and you cannot really be divided, so you kind of argue about that, or you argue about the toys. Or when you get older, your parents die, you argue over the inheritance. This is so common in the world that people argue over the inheritance. And the larger the inheritance is, the more money there is at stake, the more they argue about it. So even though there's plenty to go around, you argue even more when there's plenty to go around. It's crazy, isn't it? The more you have, the more you argue about these things, even though there's plenty for everyone. And this is kind of one of those remarkable things about craving. People never understand the limitations of craving. You are the richest person in the world and you still want more, right? That doesn't help. You have a massive inheritance from your parents, and then you argue massively. I've seen that happen in so many cases where you argue enormously over these enormous inheritances. If you became the ruler of the entire earth, like some of these great mythical kings in the suttas that we talked about the other day, the Mahasudassana Sutta, you're not happy with just one earth, right? One earth is not enough. You want another earth. Okay, let's have the solar system. Let's have the whole galaxy. And when you have the whole galaxy, one galaxy not enough. You want more. This is the problem with craving. There is no end to this. Why? Because again, you're trying to fill up a psychological problem with external things. And instead of turning around and seeing what the real problem is, you just keep on pursuing and pursuing and pursuing. And there's no end to that. Right? So even though having an entire galaxy, oh, imagine the headache of being in charge of a whole galaxy. It's a big headache, right? You have to look after it and all the beings in there and kind of administrate properly and all these kind of things. Still, you want that because you are deluded about what is going on. And this is how it goes. And this is what I was saying the other day about when there is sensual desire, when we are pursuing sensual objects in the world, it always tends to lead to conflict because we tend to want the same things. We are in competition, right? One of the things about the sort of capitalist economic system is all about competition, competing with each other and trying kind of the person with the best idea sort of wins out. But then of course, if one person wins out, the other person loses, right? And we often forget that. We often think that, yeah, I'm going to win, but there's always going to be more people who lose usually than the people who win. And, of course, that is the problem here. This is the competition problem again. Many people will suffer while other people, a few people then actually go through there. And eventually, we all suffer in this competitive system. And there will be anger, there will be fighting, there will be all of these things coming out as a consequence of the competition of finite resources. So, that is the problem here. And so this is another beautiful simile about the problems of sensual pleasures. And I will bring out this particular point a little bit more later on with a small extract from another sutta, but that will have to be after lunch because now already time is up, unfortunately. So we'll see you again after lunch and continue then.